Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
We're now through the resurrection, and Jesus has risen from the dead. We have the beginning of the tradition with the apostles and whatnot going things. And so now, Zina, it's your turn to take us here. The early church into the establishment of Easter is things that involve ritual and performance and the different kinds of traditions and things that get started at that. So I just hope that you'll just ride us on through all the things that you've found fascinating throughout your studies.
Well, I don't know much about right after we stop getting the witnesses and the witnesses of the witnesses. That's sort of more Jared's territory. But right about, you know, between the 3rd and 4th centuries is when you start getting other documents about a kind of proto-orthodoxy and Christianity that will be sort of politically acceptable. Because during those, you know, couple hundred years right after, including during the life of Christ, they were very suspicious, obviously. They were sort of anti-government people. And a lot of the assumption about the messianic hopes was that they would kick out the crummy Romans and allow them, you know, to have their own sovereignty. So that takes a couple hundred years to fade away. And then it takes, you know, the First Council of Nicaea and some other sort of big events for Easter to come to the prominence that it does in the Proto-Orthodox and then in the Western Catholic and Eastern Catholic Church, or Eastern Orthodox Church. Interestingly, it takes a while for those two branches, Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodox, to really break apart. They're not... you know, they don't just decide on a writ of divorcement or whatever. It takes a bunch of different councils. Every couple hundred years, they find that they have more disagreements, more irreconcilable differences. And so really, it's not until like the 11th century, I think 1050 something, that they actually are completely separate churches. But starting from the very beginning, in that First Council of Nicaea, there's some disagreements already that are going to inform both of the branches. And part of that is going to be the details about the theology of Easter. And without getting into too much detail, because I don't really understand it, and I would get in way too deep for myself, one of the main things that they have a problem with is deciding on how to fix the date. Or the date of Easter. They know it's going to be a movable feast because it is tied to Passover. And so ultimately they decide on what they call Septuagesima Sunday. And they're going to have...
Say that again. What was that word?
It's a great word, Septuagesima. And it means the first Sunday following the first full moon following the spring equinox.
Okay, I certainly knew that's how Easter was, but that's actually a word that says all that. That's
yeah,
funny.
Isn't that cool?
That's
yeah.
Very cool.
And so Easter Sunday is the end of the Lenten season and the first day of Eastertide, so it's the end of the 40-day sort of austerity, and Eastertide is the 50 days that it takes to get to Pentecost, to sort of, you know, the re-gifting of all the spiritual stuff that sort of dumped out on the followers of Christ. And another problem that happens here is that we have the Eastern Church following the Julian calendar and the Western Church following the Gregorian.
Okay.
And this means that in the Western Church, Septuagesima Sunday, well, the only one of those days that's fixed, and even it is kind of loosey-goosey, but the equinox of the sun of the day and the night comes at a time between March 20th and March 22nd, okay? So any of those days can be astronomically the equinox, the moment of the equinox when there are exactly 12 hours of daylight and 12 hours of, you know, 12 hours when the sun is above the horizon, 12 hours when it's below the horizon. And because that can be, that can shift by a day or so, they just decided on March 22nd. That would be it.
Okay.
So as early as you can do that is you can have the full moon on the, if you have the equinox on the 22nd, the full moon on the 23rd, then you can have Easter on the 24th if the next day is Sunday. That's the earliest it can be. And the latest it can be is April 25th, I think.
Okay.
Because any further than that, you're going to be past the time when there could be a 28-day lag between.
So we've got a really early Easter this year being on the 31st.
We do. Yeah, the earliest, it was really early. 2005, it was on the 27th of March, and that was really, really early.
Okay.
And it, you know, it varies because of the days of the week not matching up to the days of the year and the days of the month and all of that. And that's a complex system, and there were a lot of sermons that got mileage out of that fact. They would say, it's the center of everything. Christ's resurrection is the focus of the universe because it's determined by the sun and its, you know, being, and the tilt of the moon, or the tilt of the earth. It's determined by the moon because it's a lunar, Passover was a lunar thing, and it has to be the full, first full moon. And it's by the order of God interacting with humans when he said there will be 7 days, and it will, you know, so establishing a week and then a weekend is a relationship of mortals and God, and then you have the God and the moon and God and the sun, and so everything, according to them, all of the sort of spheres of existence, center around Christ's crucifixion, resurrection, the resurrection being the absolute finisher. So he is the center of creation, and that makes him also the meridian of time. It makes him the center of time, wherever that happens. So you establish Easter that way, and then you base the rest of the liturgical, a lot of the rest of the liturgical calendar on that event, on that stuff.
Okay,
so it's 50 days to Pentecost, and it's 40 days, you know, backwards to what, Ash Wednesday and that kind of thing.
Right, so when did all that, Lent and Ash Wednesday and Maundy Thursday and all the Holy Week, is this again after these early councils? And
Yeah, by 4th and 5th century, so fairly early, you start getting people saying, you know, mentioning that or making liturgical calendars that list those things. So it's probably within the first, they probably decided some of it in the first Nicene Council, and then it probably just sort of grew organically to be assumed to follow that pattern in the other places. And so there's always going to be some kind of celebration that recognizes the Jewish Passover, but by the time it becomes recognizable as this Orthodox Holy Week at the end of the Lenten season, and, you know, it's sort of response to the passing of winter and the beginnings of spring, that kind of thing, is about 200 or 300 years.
Okay. And the Lenten season, the idea of a 40-day season, mm-hmm. is this earlier than the Easter establishment, or
no? That comes with Easter as well.
Okay.
There's and the idea, Lent is actually kind of a funny word. It refers to lentils because it is the days of fasting, and fasting, you know, for LDS people, fasting means abstention from food, and it's usually 24 hours, and it's pretty strict. Some people will, you know, give it a little bit of leeway for things like prescription drugs, and
sure.
But I've known Mormons that say, you know, you don't eat or drink water or brush your teeth or bathe or chew gum. You just don't do anything, and they're pretty hardcore. But in other Christian traditions, it merely means abstention from specific things. So if you have somebody that says, you know, that saint fasted on bread and water for, then it sounds kind of strange to a Mormon. It's like, how, you're not fasting if you're on bread and water.
Right.
But if that's the only thing you're permitted, then the duration of that fast could get very, very tedious. So fasting really was a disciplines for mortifying the body, mortifying the flesh, to remind yourself of, you know, the goodnesses that God put into your life and how you would miss them were they absent, you know. So, or the 40 days.
Okay, so when you said lentil and Lenten are together, was it just they would only subsist on beans and lentils?
They would use lentils as their substitute for meat. They were, you know, I don't know how much they knew chemically about nutrition, but they did know that legumes were a good substitute for sort of filling your belly and giving you the kind of strength that meat would give you. So especially on Fridays, they would eat a sort of stew or pottage that had lentils and vegetables and whatever else they could find that wasn't meat. And then you get interesting little things where fish doesn't count as meat.
Right.
in some cases, birds are qualify as fish and things like that. So, so there's a little bit of kind of cheating or at least fudging of the boundaries of that.
Right. And you still see remnants of that today. You go to these buffet places and fish will be featured on Fridays. And I remember growing up, you know, hey, it's Friday, therefore we'll serve fish whenever you're going to have a dinner party or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, it's good manners to do that in the spring. If you don't know when Lent is, it's just a good idea that through sort of, you know, late February to April, if it's Friday, serving fish is a good idea, just in case there's someone who's observing Lent in that way. But people observe Lent in a lot of different ways, too. They give up many things. They give up, you know, the most common are physical pleasures like smoking or alcohol or caffeine, or somebody I know gives up Malamars. It's a real sacrifice. So that 40 days begins with the Mass of Ash Wednesday, which follows rather directly Mardi Gras or Fat Tuesday.
Okay, and I want to get into that. How early do we get this whole Carnival, Mardi Gras? I mean, I guess Mardi Gras means Fat Tuesday. That's what the word means, right? So here's what I'm worried about. I want to make sure that we're grounded in history as well as just kind of explaining, you know, for people who are outside people in the LDS tradition don't know a lot about Ash Wednesday, and they don't really know what Mardi Gras is all about and all that.
Okay.
So do kind of both a historical and a current.
Okay, what's interesting about the four significant astronomical points of the calendar year? You've got a solstice in midwinter and midsummer, and you have an equinox at spring and fall. And that is when the solstice is when the sun is at its most extreme point, and the equinox is equal night. It's when the sun and it's when the day and the night are equal. So at each of those, sort of way back into pagan times and, you know, pre-Christian and pre-Jewish and pre-Hebrew children of Israel, that, you know, they developed into the Jewish tradition, there were probably already sort of earth-observing religions that made a point of celebrating those four occasions in the year. So you have a year right for each of those. You have a typical celebration at midwinter will be something about light and light in the darkness. And I think I talked about this at the Christmas time one, where it's much more Christmassy to have a little candle in a dark room than it is to have the lights on. And that's because the celebration isn't one of light. It's one of light in contrast to darkness. And so it's a celebration of the sun coming back, the fact that it's gone to its farthest point and it's not going to continue to go away forever. In the summertime, then you get the most daylight and the least nighttime hours. I've been in northern England at around the solstice, and it really does. I mean, even it's not Scandinavia, it's not as far north as that, but it's still, I think there are only about 4 hours of darkness, and it wasn't really that dark, you know, just kind of the sun would set, but then it would just kind of stay twilight for another couple of hours, and then it kind of get darker, and then a little bit later it would start to get lighter, and sure enough, 4 hours after that or 3 hours after that, the sun would be peaking up. So it would, there's a really dramatic, when you're high up in the north, there's a really dramatic contrast between the darkest night of the year and the lightest day of the year. And so summer was used celebration as of not necessarily fertility, but fruitfulness. The fertility one is more in the spring. But the summer one is that everything is fruitful and things are blooming, and you know, there are some fruit are already have already come into season, like cherries, and there's others that are on their way, the apricots and peaches possibly. So there's a lot of really available, abundant, and delicious food that is not nearly as at any time of the year is not as readily available. I mean, at harvest time, there is a lot of the serious get you through the winter stuff that needs to be stored. But in the summertime, you just eat and celebrate, and that's the time when they would stomp the grapes and then bottle the stuff to make wine. And so there's the summer celebration is one of kind of, as the winter was one of, oh, it's a good thing the sun is coming back. The summer one was a celebration just of the joy of having the light there all the time anyway. And so those two could kind of get extreme in their party having. And then the two equinox celebrations were for, again, in the spring you would have fertility, because this is when you start having the animals that got pregnant in the fall are starting to have the babies in the spring. And the babies that were maybe born, the eggs that hatched last year, are now getting to the point where they're starting to lay their eggs. So you have all this abundance of new life, not just coming out of the ground in the plants, but also in the animals. And so there's a big celebration of sexuality and fertility then. And then in the fall, there is the end of the growing season and the beginning of the storage season. You have to take everything that is growing and living and slaughter it and put it in salt, or, mow down the fields and gather in the grain. And so that's the celebration of death. And so you get like Days of the Dead and things like that in October or November. And what happened was pagan holidays got more of a reputation for being the abandonment, the partying, they got associated with carnival, right? With the flesh.
Oh, that's right. Oh, I hadn't put that together. Awesome. Yeah.
And so every time you have carnival, Christianity Christianizes over it and says, yes, but it's followed by a holy day, right? You have to have something sacred follow that. So in February, usually you have what in Rome, because it's way further south, you had those sexuality fertility festivals along with the Lupercalia, which was in February rather than in, March or April, which is when it would fall for the northern countries. So the Lupercalia gets associated with the martyrdom of St. Valentine. And St. Valentine becomes the sort of Christian answer to the Lupercalia. And the Lupercalia has been too rowdy and too sexy, and so they put feast day of a fairly insignificant martyr in the place of that and say, no, it's a holy day. It's not a carnival. It's not about the fleshliness. You just go and, pray all day. And so they tried to sort of rein in the people's festivities on carnivals with these holidays. And it worked beautifully with Easter, because once you get over the Lupercalia, you can take that right from the sort of orgiastic, over the top sexuality of Lupercalia, and make that instead into a carnival that is the parading of the excess, and then we're going to treat that like it's the limbic system, or is that the word I'm looking for? Is it limbic? Or anyway, it's the system that cleans everything out right before.
Okay.
You can start getting really austere. And that's why Fat Tuesday comes before Ash Wednesday. Ash Wednesday is the day that you begin Lent. So you count back from Easter Sunday 40 days, and you find a Wednesday, and that's Ash Wednesday. And then the day before that is Fat Tuesday. And the week before that is Carnival, leading up to Fat Tuesday, culminating in Fat Tuesday. And then Ash Wednesday is the day of the hangover, where you go and you repent of all of it, because you are so, you've completely indulged in all of the flesh for carnival, and you're ready to be rid of that. You're ready to be austere for the next 40 days. And you do use that austerity of whatever fast or abstinence that you've taken on yourself to think about your mortality, to think about what Christ did for you. So there's a chance to use that as Christian reflection.
Yeah, neat.
Yeah, and every one of the holidays gets a carnival to go with it. And it's usually the observation of the pagan use of the season before. So at Christmas time, you get what's called the Feast of the Ass or the Feast of the Boy Bishop, where they turn the orderliness of regular society on its head. There's an anthropologist named Victor Turner who, for the most part, was kind of the leading voice of this. He's been challenged recently, but he's still really influential. With the idea of liminality, that there has to be, in a civic or sort of communal ritual, there has to be a moment of chaos. There has to be a time when you, like the butterfly entering its cocoon, you have to change, you have to transmogrify. So because you have that moment of liminal, the liminal means between the lines, it works psychologically. It's not one thing or the other thing. It's the doorway or the hallway. It's not a room. It's a transition place and a transition time.
And he also talks about how it's like a pressure release valve.
Yes, and that chaos, yeah, that it does. It does fulfill the function of, sort of getting your yah-yahs out before you get back down to being rigid and ordered again. And at Christmas time, one of the things that the early Christians would do all the way through the Middle Ages, where it got really kind of its own out of hand, is that everything in that liminal space of the day before Christmas or Christmas Eve, and this is reflected in The Nutcracker, which is a story, actually Tchaikovsky got it from a story by A.T.I. Hoffman, where things that aren't supposed to come to life come to life, and things that aren't supposed to speak. So the animals can talk at Christmas, and your toys can take on a life of their own at Christmas, and the gate between the worlds, heaven and hell, both are open. Again, I talked, I think, at Christmas time about the idea of ghost stories. At all four points of the calendar year, you have moments for those doors to open. And so at Christmas time, all kinds of magic comes in from the other world. At Easter time, all kinds of magic comes in from the other world. At Corpus Christi or at high summertime, that happens. And then, of course, at Halloween time, that's, what's interesting is that of all of those four seasons, the one that we've maintained the pagan part of the strongest is Halloween, where we don't have, who thinks about, November 1st is coming up, I got to prepare for All Souls or All Saints,
right.
No, but my kids are thinking about their Halloween costume, in August, because that's the night before. All Hallows Eve is the night before the Hallows come out. The Hallows are the holy ones, but the night before that, hell breaks loose, quite literally. And so you've got all the demons, pouring out of hell and partying and wreaking havoc and mischief and destruction, and because they're going to get shut down the next day.
Exactly.
When everybody is supposed to go to Mass.
Right. Another thing from my study of Turner, he was part of my master's thesis and stuff, was that the least powerful people in these societies are children, and so it's a role reversal day for them, because they now are going to demand the treat, or I will play the trick on you. And we've now made it cute into princesses and butterflies and all that stuff, but it always was ghosts and demons and witches and all the scariest things, which are truly the more occult demonic kind of things. That's what the action used to be.
Yeah, it used to be a lot more, and we are discouraged from making it too scary now. It's like, I'm going to have a visit from a cowboy tonight. I'm really terrified. it's just, now it's just the idea of disorder has kind of morphed into the idea of a new identity or a fake identity.
Yeah,
you know, so you can be your superhero, or you can be a ballerina, or you can be, you know, you can just be something or somebody else for a while, which is still, it's still suitably chaotic. It's still suitably what you are not. You know, a 4-year-old probably is not going to get to be a fireman, but he sure likes to be it while he's got, you know, a chance to hit people up for candy.
Wonderful.
So it's still a fun celebration that way. So yeah, you have the moment of chaos that can then serve as the pressure valve to make sure that the rest of the year you're okay. It gives you a chance to confront, as Alcoholics Anonymous puts it, hug your demons or they will bite you in the behind. If you don't confront them at least once a year, they're going to be a lot scarier than if you do acknowledge that they're there and then walk them back into hell. So, you know, the people who go postal, you know, they interview the neighbors and it's always, he was really quiet. Well, he was really quiet because he was, you know, the pressure valve never got a chance to be released, kind of thing. That's sort of the idea psychologically behind letting the pressure valve do its work. I don't know if it works or not, you know, sociologically, but the boy bishop was, just like what you were talking about, we let the children take over. And at Christmas time for the 12 to 24 hours prior to Christmas Day, they would crown somebody king or mayor or bishop who definitely couldn't, you know, would not normally be entitled to that. And it would be a little boy or it would be a donkey. So you'd have the Feast of the Ass on the 23rd or 24th to celebrate the chaos, to make sure Carnival happened before the body of Christ came physically into the world in the manger. Interestingly, they did not have a suitable one of these for Midsummer, for High Summer, until fairly late in the game. They started celebrating a festival called Corpus Christi, but not until after about 1310. A woman, actually, named Juliana of Cornelium, had a vision that Christ... a vision of Christ who came to her and said that my church is forgetting what and who they are, that they are not, that they are my body, my flesh and blood. When they take communion, they're actually, you know, ingesting and therefore perpetuating my body, and they have forgotten this. You need to talk to somebody and help reestablish. And she actually refuses for several years to tell anyone that she's had a vision because she feels inadequate as a female to have received that kind of dream vision. But she gets very ill until she breaks down and goes to her confessor and says, I, you know, experienced this. Christ wants us to pay attention to Paul's letter, where he says, ye are the body of Christ, and, you know, can the foot say to the head say to the foot, I have no need of thee. And so we need to make that more literal. The way they decide to do that is to make a festival that for a while is celebrated at Easter time. And then as Midsummer becomes more and more out of control for the poor church people, they move it. And this happens sort of severally. It happens, Corpus Christi spreads all over Europe, but the date for it changes place to place and time to time. But by the end of the 14th century, it's almost universally done at Midsummer, so it's from June 20th to June 22nd, and it's done with dramatizing, with a festival of theater, where they actually get together and put on plays. The entire, if you have a city that's big enough for a cathedral, big enough to have an episcopal see, a seat that has a bishop or archbishop, you are assigned by the city, by the law of the city and the law of the church, to put together a festival for Midsummer that involves the cycle of the Bible plays. And sometimes, some years they would do as many as, you know, 20 or 40 of these plays, and some years they would probably do fewer. But there were people that were willing to participate in these things from a civic point of view. It's kind of like if you've ever been in Provo, Utah, at the 4th of July, this is, you know, a huge civic festival, and lots of different elements of the city get involved in putting together the 4th of July stuff, the Independence Day parade, and then the Stadium of Fire, and then there's essay contests and speech contests and the beauty pageants and, you know, all kinds of different enterprises for, you know, taking advantage of the fact that there's going to be crowds. And with that, you have to have sort of increased security and everything. So it was really similar. That these were these Christian festivals where they, you know, would assign each of the trade guilds, the city searchers, or the leaders of the community, would have meetings as early as January, where they assigned plays and expectations of those plays being performed and done well to each of the trade guilds. And so they might say, you know what, we've got a play of the creation. The carpenters can do that because they've got all kinds of stuff they can make props out of. And then we've got the play of the, you know, eating of the fruit in the Garden of Eden. Let's make the greengrocers take that one because they've got fruit. And sometimes it was just sort of an arbitrary assignment, but sometimes there was, you know, a connection between which trade guild got which play. And they took the plays from the Bible that were presentable as dramatization stories of about 15 to 40 minutes. And each trade guild would then put their production on a pageant wagon. These pageant wagons could be really small. They could be like 8 by 10 or 6 by 8, or they could be really big, 12 by 14 maybe. But that was their stage, and they could do a lot of things on that particular little platform to show, you know, the narrative of the plot points of their story. And they got through them fairly quickly. Some of the scripts are really sparse and probably allowed for a little bit of improvisation, but some of them were really elaborate and really beautiful. And some of our best, you know, some of our best medieval literature comes from the Corpus Christi mystery cycles of the greatest hits of the Bible plays, you know, from, especially in Germany and Italy, there's some really beautiful ones. And then in England, we've got the York cycle still exists in its entirety, which is really amazing that they were able to save it that long. And there are a couple of others. The Wakefield Master has some really great plays, and the End Town. And so there are survivals of these and lots of evidence. People, trade guilds, putting a lot of resources and effort into their production of this.
Right.
And that would have been a real burden at the same time as Easter, I think, for any ecclesiastical unit, as well as for the trade guilds. I think that would put a lot of pressure on them. I think that's one of the main reasons that they moved back to the summertime.
To midsummer,
the reason,
yeah.
You know, there are probably other reasons, and one of them being, you know, that it is a festival of celebration of eating things, and the Eucharist is literal eating, so why not make it about the time when things are, you know, easy to come by, where there's a lot of abundant fruit and vegetables, and the animals are pretty fat and happy and easily picked off or for devouring. So that was an Easter thing that got moved, but it also was supposed to be about the resurrection and about what it meant to be part of Christ's church and what it meant to really celebrate the Last Supper as the Eucharistic host for Christ's body.
Awesome, man. Again, I said it at Christmas time, but you play with interesting materials through your studies. I just,
it is pretty neat. Yeah. One of my favorite plays from the Corpus Christi cycle, the fact that the scriptures had not been canonized to the point that we have them, they obviously were not using the King James Version, let alone any of the other modern versions of the scriptures, meant that they have some cycles of the Corpus Christi plays include apocryphal stories and apocryphal details from stories. Like you have Noah's wife taking on she's kind of a Punch and Judy, domestic violence is hilarious kind of role, where she objects to Noah's building the ark. And that's completely not in the Bible, but it makes for, you know, a good comic relief after we just saw poor Isaac almost sacrificed by his daddy. And then they included from the Gospel of Nicodemus, the harrowing of hell, where Christ goes down and has a debatio, a debate, an argument with Satan, and pounds down the walls of hell and approaches all of the damned from before his crucifixion and holds his hand out to Eve and takes Eve by the hand and leads her, who leads Adam, who leads Seth, out of hell and into heaven. And that's a really sweet one. But still, you know, didn't make it into the scriptures because there was no eyewitness to hell. But in Nicodemus, it's there. And so they put it in the plays, and it's a very affecting play. It's really, yeah, really great.
Very, very cool. And just one quick tie for Shakespeare folks, the whole Midnight Summer Night Dream and Bottom and his gang, there are a guild that are, preparing to do one of these. So, yeah, that you were talking about for Corpus Christi, Midsummer. Awesome. I love, anyway, just love it. So, Zina, there's one thing that I just don't want to get too far again, because we've been talking about pagan symbols and things like that. And so I know we have bunnies, we've got eggs, we've got these different things.
Right.
When did those sort of show up in the whole, you know, mix with the holy stuff?
Well, I'm not sure if they ever showed up in the whole mix. I mean, I think that, again, what happened was over the years, people started using the symbols that were already there for the seasons as an excuse to talk about the Christian things. And I think that an egg is the perfect example of this. It looks inert, but there's something alive inside it. It's the empty tomb because it looks like a stone, but there's something that is not dead inside it. It's Christ has come to life and will knock his way out of that. And so eggs are, you know, a sign of life that looks like a stone. And then bunnies had always just been, you know, a celebration of the fact that they are so fertile and it happens so fast. I think their gestation period is like 20 minutes or something. They start popping babies out. They have, but they're really, really fecund. You know, they have big litters of little kits that come out and they're incredibly cute too. Nobody can deny that. So there's always been an emphasis on baby animals, but mostly because we're going to be really lucky. We're going to have a lot to eat. We're going to have enough to support the whole household or whatever. If the babies keep coming, if we keep having enough, you know, little ones, we'll have bigger ones and we can maintain the whole flock and the whole herd. And so there's a great celebration of that. And then that comes just along with, and so they run parallel rather than really being part of Easter.
Right.
But the name itself means, you know, fertility goddess. Ister is the Norse goddess who gives her name to the season. And she is the same person we get estrogen, and to estivate is to sleep through the summer instead of the winter. And to be in estrus is to be in sort of on heat. If you're a female animal, that's the time when you're ovulating so you can have babies. So her name goes with fertility, not with Christian resurrection.
Right. Good, good. And was there any tradition of little gifts and things to children at this time or anything too? Or that's just stuff that sort of came out later?
Yeah, I think that did come later. I think it came with the fact that for many children, and this still happens, the Easter Sunday, the converts and children who are 7 years old receive their first communion at the Holy Eucharist of Easter Sunday.
The
fact that they are getting their, you know, the whole class of that year's 7-year-olds in the congregation receives communion together, and that means that they're going to also be getting, you know, welcome gifts from the community to say you're part of the body of Christ now, you have had the Eucharist, and you're, you know, you've passed that big rite of passage into full conscious Christianity. And so, yeah, welcome aboard, and they do give gifts at that point. And I'm sure that's part of it.
Yeah.
But it's not just, you know, obviously not going to be just for 7-year-olds.
Sure, sure.
So, but the fact of the gifts, I think, probably does tie in with the catechumens getting their first chance then.
Awesome. Well, great stuff. Thank you so much. Yeah, and I love all this material. Let's now do, again, I'm conscious of Mormons, and we are not high liturgy. You know, we don't have a whole lot of things that go on. There was interesting, I don't know if any of you guys saw Peggy Fletcher Stack, I'll I'll link to the article, but this week she talked about how more and more Mormons are finding this lack of celebration of Easter and no Lent and all that stuff, you know, a real thing, and so they're beginning to practice it left and right. And so there is this sort of sense among many Latter-day Saints that there's something missing from our tradition in that we don't do the whole Holy Week stuff and we don't do Lent and things. And so I think there's not only that, but there's just a lack of even information about it. So what we hear terms like Good Friday, and we hear terms mm-hmm. like Maundy Thursday, and we know about Palm Sunday vaguely from this, you know, this stuff yeah. in the scriptures. And so I'd really love to just go into Holy Week and all the terms and stations of the cross and what all that stuff just means, just because okay. it's all associated in this season. So, and everybody jump in as they're ready and have something to share. So go ahead, Zina.
Okay. I can give you some basic terminology for the week. The Palm Sunday, as you mentioned, is the Sunday when the palms, there's actual palm fronds from the trees that are blessed and then waved in the procession as the Eucharist goes by. So that it is a reenactment of the entry, the triumphal entry, Christ on the donkey fulfilling a prophecy that the Messiah would ride an ass into the city of Jerusalem. And they did. They waved palm fronds, and so they reenact that with the congregation having a chance to do that very thing. That's part of their Palm Sunday celebration. And
that would be officially the kickoff of Holy Week.
Exactly.
The Sunday before Easter. Okay.
And one right. just sort of random Mormon tie-in is that we have the hymn in our hymn book that is most frequently sung in other churches while they do the processional around their church with the palm fronds. So I think it's number 169, All Glory, Laud, and Honor in our hymn book. And it makes no sense in a Mormon context, really. You know, I mean, like, you have no idea what the context would be. But,
yeah,
but
and in fact, that's fascinating, because from Ash Wednesday through Palm Sunday, that is forbidden. You're not allowed to sing All Glory, Laud, and Honor. That isn't appropriate during the time of mourning and preparation for the death of Christ, but it is sung at the celebration of Easter. So that becomes the first time that you can sing it.
And lots of churches have a sort of stripped down musical tradition. So the like the psalms get sung in plain song instead of in the sort of harmonized chant that they do the rest of the year, or you know, they just it varies in different churches, but the music usually reflects some sense of austerity.
Wow,
interesting.
Yeah.
That is fascinating. Cool. Yep. Okay, so Palm Sunday, so in a traditional, at least high liturgical Christian community, you would probably have the congregation would order some palm fronds, and, you know, at least everyone would have a little piece, and there'd mm-hmm. be this thing. And so what is the general mood and you know, what's the feeling like? 'Cause
that one's very, very festive. That one's very festive. And the Gloria being sung is, you know, noticed. And then from Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday are all holy, Holy Monday, Holy Tuesday, and Holy Wednesday. And those have different sort of assigned liturgical elements to them. There's certain liberties taken, but the Monday reading is the anointing at Bethany, which is a little bit out of order for some of the narratives of Holy Week, but it's just generally, it's kind of conventionally done on Monday, which is the story where the woman, sometimes named as Mary of Bethany, but it's usually unnamed, and I think she's unnamed in the most significant passage of it, which is John 12, I think. Is that right, Jared?
Yeah, well, she actually is named in that one, and it is very
is
clear.
She? Oh, okay.
It's Mary and Bethany.
Okay.
The very beginning of John 12 says, 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, the home of Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So this is just after the raising of Lazarus from the dead. There gave dinner for him. Martha served, and Lazarus was one of those at the table with Mary. With him, Mary took a pound of costly perfume made of pure nard, and so forth. So that's not Mary Magdalene, but it is Mary of Bethany.
So that's the Monday reading. The Monday reading.
That's the Monday one, and they make a deal out of the fact that there's holy oil there, and so a lot of times they'll do a blessing of the chrism, which is their word for holy oil. They will make that sort of new for the following year. They'll bless all the chrism that will be used. And they, I think that's moved recently, like maybe after Vatican II, even that recently, it's moved to Maundy Thursday instead of doing it on Monday.
Oh,
anyway, okay. The next little chunk is the tenebrae, the darkness in the land, and that is they actually switch and do matins at night. They do the normal lauds and matins, which are daytime liturgies. They do them at night. They do them in the dark. And then on Wednesday, I think...
What is it during the last week of Christ's life that would end up on Tuesday? Was there some event?
I'm not entirely sure why, you know, the reasons that they give exactly for flipping it upside down like that. But it's definitely a foreshadowing of the darkness to come when Christ is crucified. And it also, I think, just logistically sort of works out to fit all the different ceremonies and different readings and things in, sort of packs them in. And also, in a lot of buildings, the cathedrals or the parish churches, there are so many people that want to participate during Holy Week that they have more sessions and more ceremonies and more masses available. And so they sort of do them round the clock kind of thing.
Okay.
But there is also a time starting with Spy Wednesday after they have shouted, you know, crucify him.
Wait. So that's the first time you've given us that term. So this is the Tuesday.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So now take us to what are the big events on Wednesday and what are the readings?
Wednesday is the mass of the deception and treachery of Judas, where he reports to the authorities and they come for Christ. And it's the sort of, again, this is a little bit out of order because they take him away and put him on trial. And the celebrants are representing the Eucharist or whatever Christ figure, the cross, as if that were Jesus. And the same people in the congregation that just a few days ago said, Hosanna to God and the Lamb, as he, you know, with their palm fronds as he came in, are now assigned. Their part is to shout, crucify him, crucify him, crucify him. And there are still congregations where this happens. And there's one of my friends when I went to Catholic University said that was one of the most powerful parts of Holy Week for her, was to recognize, to own the guilt of having celebrated him and then turned on him in a matter of just days.
Right.
And so everybody is sort of participating in being their own little tiny Judas, right? They're sort of tapping into that part of their personality that would say, after I recognized who you were, I'm still going to betray you. I'm like Peter. I'm like Judas. I'm in as much in need of a salvation and atonement as anybody who's, you know,
right,
the gravest of sinners.
And yeah, so and that ties into Christine. You talked about singing that at the Bach. And is that thing that you're talking about, Christine, that series of things, that's all performed on one night? It's not necessarily just on a Wednesday, is it?
I mean, the Bach Passions are sort of older. They don't fit in. I don't know if they ever would have been done all at once in a Lutheran service, but they aren't now in any case. I mean, they're usually done in a concert setting. You
okay.
Know.
It's not tied to a particular day of the Holy Week.
Mm-mm.
Okay. But yeah, I love that. And I even think there's something in Peggy's article about this as a missing element for Latter-day Saints and stuff, that those who've, you know, come to Mormonism from other traditions miss that really powerful thing that you're just talking about there, Zina, and what you talked about, Christine, earlier. Yeah, that it's even me who, you know, I'm the betrayer as well. Okay, and then, Zina, you mentioned that this was out of order, meaning because Judas's betrayal is after the Last Supper, which isn't celebrated
right. In
Holy Week until Maundy Thursday. Right. So,
yeah.
And what does the word Maundy, M-A-U-N-D-Y, mean? Or anybody know?
Well, Maundy is actually, it means, lots of people think it's derived from mandatum, the Latin word for commandment. So a new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I have loved you.
Yeah, and it sounds like in French, required or demanded is demander, so Monday.
Yeah.
Like that's
right.
That's mm-hmm. It's very similar. While I'm talking, I also wanted to weigh in about this whole hunger for high liturgy, and that's something I very much feel and can speak to that. And for example, when I went to the Cathedral of the Madeleines Christmas service, I was just transported recorded. I love the candles and the darkness and the call and response and the, I really love it. I really love high ritual. And we have some of that in the temple, and I'm glad.
Yep.
But yeah, I am definitely one who hungers for that higher level of embodied and ritualistic worship.
Yeah, and it's so beautiful. They when they put so much sort of thought and energy and sort of spiritual resources into making it as beautiful as they can or as meaningful as they can. If it's not beautiful, it's, you know, if it's meant to be an ugly thing, they make it ugly. And if it's meant to be a shocking thing, they make it shocking. It's shocking to have to chant crucify him, you know. So that ends up being really, really lovely. And then, but it is the Mass of the Lord's Supper. So that's the one where they really, really emphasize the Eucharist. And this is actually the first of 3 days of celebrating the Eucharist in sort of different, you know, we're going to talk about the Eucharist in three different ways on three different days, and that's called the Triduum. And Thursday, Friday, Saturday all count as the Triduum, and they're going to be sort of building up to the fact of his physical death and physical resurrection. So you've got Thursday, the emphasis is on Eucharist and how the Catholic priesthood will get the authority from Christ to distribute the Eucharist, and it comes with the washing of the feet and the celebration of brotherly love that came also in the feast in the Last Supper. I don't know that they did this before the about the 5th or 6th century, but I know that in monasticism, in the tradition of being monks or, you know, removing yourself from the world to just be devoted to Christ or to whatever religious tradition you're devoted to, the monastic movement at first was eremitic. It was solitary. It said, we are going to just go into the wilderness and think about things and meditate and become like a guru or, you know, a hermit. And it was St. Basil of Caesarea that sort of set the ball rolling for cenobitical monasticism or communal monasticism by his famous statement, if you live alone, whose feet will you wash? So if you want to, you know, want to study, if you want to do, you know, pursue the via imitatio Christi, the way of the imitation of Christ, he didn't just meditate and abstain from things and think about, you know, try to commune with God. He also communed with other people. And this starts the idea of having 12 men and one Abba, one abbot, living together so that you can celebrate the humanity of each other by washing feet and by serving each other as well. So now Thursday is the day when that happens as well, because Christ washes his disciples' feet, and in a lot of congregations, they'll have 12 men that are chosen from the congregation that come up and have their feet washed. And I think in Protestant tradition, a lot of them will have a woman and a man who wash the feet of all of the congregants, and that's a really touching kind of ceremony, too.
Very cool. Okay, so anything more, Christine or Jared, on Thursday, the events or rituals?
There is one more thing that happens on during the Triduum that I'm aware of, and it could be on Thursday. Sometimes it might happen at the end of Wednesday, but I think it's Thursday as well. The crosses, the crucifixions that show, that have the corpus, cross is just the two pieces of wood. A crucifixion is two pieces of wood that have Christ hanging on. They're removed and they're veiled. So all throughout the church, wherever there is a crucifix, he's hidden. And again, this used to be with significant colors. I think they used to veil them before Friday or Saturday in purple, and then they change it to white or something. But I know that the idea is you cannot, at this point in reenacting the history and this sort of salvation history that's out of time, you can't be constantly aware of what's going to happen to him. So we will hide that, we'll veil that, and then we will reveal it on the horrible day of Good Friday when it actually happens, right?
Veiling
of the crosses is important too.
Go ahead, Christine, please.
Oh, I was going to say, I don't know how it is in other churches, but in the Episcopal Church where I sing, they do it at the end of the Tenebrae service on Wednesday evening.
Yeah, see, that's what I was thinking. They do it either Wednesday or on Sunday.
Yeah, you start off in a church that's dark except for the candles on the altar, and then one by one, those are extinguished until it's completely dark at the end of the service, and then they strip the altar. They take everything off, the cross and, you know, all the every decorative element, and it's so that it's just empty.
Bare,
Until Friday.
Okay, that's fascinating. Yeah, just all this changing physical space and really knowing that you're entering into a story and normal things are different here is such an important thing to go through cyclically. It's just very, very important. Good. Okay, so now we're about ready to go to Good Friday?
Yeah. Maybe I can put some links to the music that's typically sung on Maundy Thursday, because there's one text called Ubi Caritas that is almost always a part of the Maundy Thursday service, and it's really especially beautiful. So I'll give you links to a couple settings of it and a translation.
Thank you.
But that's really great. And I guess maybe just some encouragement to go find a church that does the washing of feet and do it once. Because I think even if you don't love the high church stuff, and I do, I definitely long for that. But there's something really potent about washing someone's feet. And I've done it a couple of times with a friend that I invited to the service, and then a couple of times with just, random people that I got matched up with in the church. And I really love it both ways. It's just, it's so tender and intimate and vulnerable to have, somebody looking at your feet and doing it to someone else. It makes the Gospels come alive when you read them in a way that I think there's almost no other way I can imagine that being quite so vivid.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.